Ready? Okay. Larry's going to introduce our next speaker. So my job is just to get all of you animals sitting down and ready. So with that, I'll hand it over to Larry. Thank you very much.
Hello again. Art Money is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Command, Control, Communications, and Intelligence. He's also the Department of Defense Chief Information Officer. And prior to becoming the Assistant Secretary, he served as the Assistant Secretary for the Air Force for Research, Development, and Acquisition, and was the CIO in the Air Force from January 96 to February 98. He's worked a long time in private industry. He was vice president of ESL, a subsidiary of TRW, and president and deputy general manager of TRW Avionics and Surveillance Group. He's got nearly 40 years of management and engineering experience in the defense, electronics, and intelligence industry. And we are very, very fortunate that he's here with us today. I believe that his being here today, flying in here to give this talk, is testimony to his commitment and belief in the kind of work that we do. So please help me welcome Mr. Art Money.
I kind of feel like the last act as the circus tent's collapsing. But it is a pleasure to be here. What I thought I would do today is to share with you what DOD is doing to ensure operations, both from a warfighting standpoint, but also from a business standpoint. My job as CIO for the DOD, or the Assistant Secretary of Defense for C3I, is in fact simply to make information superiority work. That's the definition of information superiority is to ensure an uninterrupted flow of information takes place anywhere in the world, while at the same time denying an adversary the same. I realize that I stand here between you and a lively evening in Las Vegas, so maybe because that's subdued, maybe it was a lively evening last night. Well, we'll try it again. So I thought I'd get right to the point, but I believe something like 10, 15 minutes, and then depending on your stamina and or mine, we'll take a question or two. But I believe everybody wants to end here by 6. The DOD, my main point, let me just go to the bottom line, is the DOD is not isolated in the United States, or for that matter in the world. And what do I mean by that is that we're very dependent upon infrastructure that resides in the commercial or the private sector. Therefore, when you look at what the DOD does to be whole, to be operationally fit, to sustain operations daily worldwide, to be at the desired state of readiness, we must be very dependent on what private industry or the commercial market is. Consequently, we want them to have that same state of readiness, whether it's in the power or the transportation or the water services or the food or the telecommunications, or for that matter in the financial sector. So what are we in the DOD doing? Now, I appreciate, I think, the cross-section of this audience, and so it reminded me that what a former congressman said about the government, and the government's is like a patient suffering from a fever. Its attitude towards reform, or to change, or in this context, to fix a problem, comes in fits and starts, interspersed by periods of profound coma. Well, that didn't go over too good. What's missing then? Let me try another one. I think some of you will remember Ronald Reagan. He, when he was governor of California, he made a mention that government is, after all, like a baby's digestive channel. It has a healthy appetite at one end and a little sense of responsibility at the other. Oh, we're doing better. Okay, we're warming up. I kind of identify with that because I've been, as Larry mentioned, started my fifth year in the government after 34 years in industry. And there does take a lot of inertia to move. There's a lot of fits and starts. But I can attest that there's no longer a profound coma within the Defense Department. Y2K had a lot to do with that. We spent upwards of $4 billion. Frankly, we spent more than that, but that's really all the that we accounted for. The rest was in, there's no fraud, waste, or abuse here now. The rest were in operations and maintenance accounts and was hard to find. But what that effort did was point out how vulnerable, how fragile, how ill-equipped the DoD was to run end-to-end operations. Prior to that time, we built programs, we tested that program, we didn't test the end-to-end thread, if you will. So the first time with Y2K, we had end-to-end testing as described by whatever the sink. We have 9 different sinks in the world. Whatever they needed to conduct operations, they defined then what this thread that was to be tested. When we tested them, there was 33 of these. This was not an exhaustive test, but it was representative. We found all kinds of problems. Very few had anything to do with a calendar. But there was interface problems, there was lack of standards, or there were standards that were not met, and so forth. When we put that together then, that really motivated the DoD and consequently spilled over to other parts of the government to get its act more together. Don't hear this as we've got it solved, but I think we're a hell of a lot better off than we were just a year or two ago. So when you put that together, the quest for information superiority really then resides in providing information assurance and protection of critical infrastructure. As I said earlier, but let me reiterate, information superiority is the key enabler to what we call Joint Vision 2010. This is the vision that the Department of Defense has to fight and win America's wars. It was first institutionalized by General Shalikashvili about 3-4 years ago now, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There's several tenets in this joint vision, but information superiority is really the heart of it. And in that context, we have what we refer to as a revolution in military affairs, but without information superiority, we wouldn't be anywhere. Another definition of information superiority is the right information to the right people at the right time in the right format. In this era, we don't have time to reformat messages. Last year we had 22,144 attacks, cyber attacks on the DoD. These weren't pings, these were attacks. We don't have time to scroll around reformatting messages when we're under an attack. Some of those attacks may have originated in this room. Some of them, for clearly, were foreign state-sponsored attacks. So this is no longer shits and giggles. This is serious stuff, and your DoD needs to ride through any of that so we, in fact, can conduct operations anywhere in the world. So the synergy of what my job is, the consolidation of C3I, Command Control Communications and Intelligence, and the CIO of the Defense Department, is, in fact, has a lot of calculation behind it, bringing those two together. My responsibility is not only for the RMA, the Revolution of Military Affairs, ensuring the warfighter can do whatever he needs, but also the Revolution in Business Affairs. In that context, what does the department need to do to improve, conduct business, etc.? About 20 years ago, Alan Toffler, talking about technology, said, we're moving, quote, we're moving out of the age of mass into the age of information control. He went on to say, the sword of knowledge can cut off the arm that wields it, and that unless you tame technology, you will encounter the future shock. And I believe that's what we're about today, and that's what I think this conference is about, and clearly that's what we're doing in the department when it gets to information superiority / information assurance. Think back, in just less than one generation, the information revolution, as epitomized or defined as characterized by the introduction of network computers into a virtually dimensionless society, has that information revolution has changed how our economics work. Last year at Christmas, we had several billion in e-commerce, about 10x more than we had the previous year. Wait till we see this year, although the distributed denial of services that we experienced earlier this year has put a little bit of a dent in that, in the confidence at least. So how our economy works has changed. How we structure our everyday lives. How many microprocessors do you have in everything you touch? It's probably in the 50 to 100s or more. How we provide national and international security is clearing information. The information, let me give you an example. Not that many years ago, 10 years ago, we had in Mogadishu, a ranger, 19 rangers were killed, drugged through the streets of Mogadishu. That was instantaneously on CNN and ITN. It wasn't a tactical event, it was a worldwide event. More recently, on the border of Macedonia, the border where we had three GIs captured immediately, within 2 minutes, that was in the White House. No longer do we have this echelon after echelon contemplating, understanding what's going on and then reporting up. There's a massive parallel effect going on. That affects us, affects what we do. Reaction of the American public, for that matter, the international public, has a lot to do with then formulating what we do in a policy sense. So drawing on the information age, we've really entered a new era. The interdependency, again back to infrastructures, et cetera, but also the interconnectivity. And I assert this era cannot be reversed. Given the implication of the interdependencies in the military arena, we must take the steps to understand and manage these risks so that their potential negative impact is negligible so we can achieve what we call mission success. Just another example or two. We had an occasion here in Kosovo, information exploded. Having the communication responsibility from a policy and guidance and oversight standpoint is executed through what we call the J6 on the Joint Chiefs. We entered the Kosovo conflict well knowing that the backbone into Kosovo across Europe, whether that's land-based or satellite-based, was far less than what was needed. We ended up using 850 million bits per second to fight what we call a small-scale contingency. If that was 5 years earlier, we would have been using a factor of 10 less than that. All I'm trying to demonstrate is the explosion in the amount of information needed to conduct operations, and who needs that massive amount of information is everybody from the president down to the individual soldier on the field, if you will. So in just a few months, if you go back to Desert Storm, 5 years transpired that we have exploded in tenfold in the amount of information required. Again, back to interdependency, infrastructure that was needed. How we conducted the Kosovo operation was mostly over commercially leased lines and commercially leased satellites. Again, maybe emphasizing the need for interdependency and solving critical infrastructure protection problems across the entire spectrum. Information security is, hopefully I'm making the point, is essential to the United States military to achieve its, whatever the mission it's called upon to conduct, and at the same time deny an adversary the ability to disrupt that information. Let me go to an incident that happened in February of 98. That was essentially my first day on the job in C3I. We were building up to conduct operations in Southwest Asia. Saddam Hussein was out of the box, and we were going to get him back in the box. At the same time, we had experienced a massive 100 Air Force bases were simultaneously attacked. Later on, we found out the Army and the Navy were being attacked. We didn't know it at the time because we had no intrusion devices in the Army and the Navy. We had 98 or so of the 100 Air Force bases covered. That attack then took us 3 weeks to figure out what was going on. You might say, why did it take 3 weeks to find out it was two kids in California? They were mentored, by the way, maybe even duped by Israelis. We don't know what the intent of the Israelis were when this was going on. We do, in fact, know that the kids were just having a good time. But it damn near brought the Department of Defense to its knees in the context of you immediately lose confidence in any of the data you have. You don't know whether it was disrupted, corrupted, or not. It took 3 weeks to figure this out because the laws in the United States, which I totally support, are arcane and antiquated when it comes to cyber. Each leg of these attacks, normally there was 8 legs in each one, would require a wiretap order. A wiretap order requires you go physically before a judge with a massive amount of paper to justify why you need the wiretap. You do this in a static situation, not in a dynamic situation like when you're under a cyber attack. So it took 3 weeks to sort this out, and frankly, that was due to the cooperation of several system administrators along the line. So we were instituting some legislative changes. If it's a protected entity called the Department of Defense or other critical infrastructure in the United States, if this law passes, an attack on that protected entity is no longer a law enforcement act, it is a National Security Act. The title changes rapidly. That then gives the DOD the facility to track back, trace back, and in fact, shoot back. So things are changing. There's some laws that are going to be modified to help us. I'm talking a lot today about the military side. Let me also emphasize the business side. The budget in the Department of Defense is roughly $300 billion a year. What that means is $35 million an hour are being transmitted somewhere. That's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that transaction or those transactions also need to have an incredible amount of information assurance wrapped around them. What we're looking at in that regard when we talk about information assurance, a term that maybe is not totally embraced in the private sector, but we mean by that is the availability of whatever the network or the circuit is, the confidentiality, meaning that that information is not public. The integrity of that information has not been corrupted. The authentication of that information in the users and the receivers is in fact in place. And non-repudiation also takes place, meaning the digital signature of on a contract is binding, and there was just a law passed the other day that mentioned that. Or in the case of the military, an order was in fact received and you can't deny that you had it. So things are changing in that regard. But we still have a long way to go. The other risks are the weaknesses of the defense information infrastructure. But when I say that, there's not just mean defense. Most of the communications, 90% of the communications that are DOD reside in the commercial sector or go over commercial or privately satellites or, for that matter, landlines. But to protect that, the threat from an operational readiness standpoint requires us, in fact, to increase information assurance. We have a plan well along the way. We're about to roll out PKI, public key infrastructure, across initially 2, going to 4, going to 7 million the most massive deployment of PKI anywhere. All that is in a triad of training people, of having the right resources, the right technology, and clearly the right operational picture to do that. The strategy recognizes that no single element or component of the security of this information can be provided solely. The concept involves the use of layered security solutions, which allow us to maximize the use of COTS, commercial off-the-shelf technology. It was mentioned earlier, I was in the Air Force in acquisition. My job today in C3I is acquisition of essentially information technology. If you look at the way the DoD racks up the dollars and puts them into bins called program elements or line items, we can account for something like $15 billion a year in computers and IT kind of stuff. But when you roll it across weapon systems, satellites, airplanes, business practices, and so forth, you're probably talking a third of the DoD budget, so roughly $100 billion a year. That's the kind of leverage the DoD is looking at, but we're not building this internal. We're going to the commercial marketplace. We buy this, whatever this is, off the shelf. There's a very few items that are not available that we need. A gigabit per second encryptor is probably not commercially available, and we need those types of things. Part of this is we talked about the malicious outsider coming in, but also we're also worried about the malicious insider. So part of what we're doing is not only looking out, but we're also looking within. Hopefully this gives you a little bit of a feel for what we're about and what we're trying to do. Don't hear this is all well in place, but there's several plans, and it will be well in place in the next couple of years. So in conclusion, let me say, I'll give you a little quote here from Lord Bancroft. He once said, a speech is like a love affair. Any fool can give a speech or start a speech, but it takes considerable expertise to end one. Thank you very much. I don't know where Joe is or Ken. Is this it, or you want to take questions? Oh, there you are. How about a question or two? Way back there.
Yes, you, sir. Go ahead.
We can hear you. I'm old, but I still have hearing. I hate to cut you off, but we don't hear it all, so maybe I'm older than I thought. Can you yell a little louder? Okay. Who else? Anybody up front? Yes.
You mentioned you're implementing PKI in a big way. Will each department be its own little island?
No. The question was, we're implementing PKI in a big way. Will each department or whatever do its own thing? No. The other part of information superiority is interoperability. So as much as folks, this is a centralized, top-down driven solution, otherwise we will fall apart because we won't be able to talk to each other in an interoperable sense. Yes?
So what are your comments about how the U.S. has a very powerful and will spend a lot of time shaping and molding the way in which what is deemed to be right, wrong, and otherwise on the internet, and the use of the internet, yet the internet is really a global utility.
Let's see, I'm not sure I understand the question. We do not oppose the internet. In fact, the internet saves our bacon often. East Timor, when that rebellion occurred, there's 39 nations in the Pacific and a few in Europe that had wanted to come together to go help solve the East Timor problem. What we did was use the internet to solve the interoperability problem. We sent out encryption devices to all 39, but we used the internet as the connectivity. So we're not opposed to the internet at all. We're connected to the internet in more ways than I could tell you, more ways than I know. But we do need to put some firewalls and defense in depth between the internet and our intranet because of the attacks and so forth. So did I understand your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Well, it's not, I can appreciate that, and it's probably been confusing, but just 2 weeks ago we relaxed. Though, thank you. The question was, what are we doing about cryptology? And essentially, I'm going to paraphrase the question. Do we support or what? What's going on in the cryptology area? Let's see, the commercial cryptology, the United States just went through another relaxation of 128 bits anywhere in the world, and we're not fighting that. Any American company can go ahead and do that. So to me, it's recognizing a reality, not falling down on our sword in front of it. So we support it. Yes. We're not doing real well. We realize that, well, what the hell's wrong with the rest of you? Can't you hear? The question is, or was, what are we doing about keeping talent, retaining people in the military and the DOD and the services, etc., with the competitive pressures from the outside? And I said, we're not doing very well. Now, we also understand part of the DOD has been, I'll get to you, so you may want to rest your arm. Part of the DOD is, over the years, has been the major engine in R&D. I don't know if you appreciate that. The amount of money the Department of Defense has spent in R&D has been a major engine in driving the United States. It may be changing a little bit now with, in the old days, when I first started, most of the technology was that made a difference was kept within the department, maybe even classified, probably was classified. That's no longer the case. In the IT area, we're following what industry is doing. So, but there's still a healthy amount of money putting into R&D. It's also appreciated in the department. Part of our responsibility is training people, not only for the military, but also for the private sector, and again, another engine for the economy. We would like to retain more pilots than we're retaining. We'd like to retain more system administrators or people that have IT expertise than we are. So what are we doing? We're trying to appreciating that we're going to have some attrition. When a staff sergeant that makes $30,000 a year gets offered $90,000 or $120,000 a year as doing a similar type job as he or she is doing in the military, yes, at times that's damn difficult to keep them. But I want to tell you, after 35 years in industry, I have never, and this is a true statement, I've said it multiple times in other forum, I have never seen more dedicated, professional, competent people than I see in the military or in the Department of Defense. And some of those people serve as service before self, and also from a high degree of integrity, and clearly from an excellence in all we do. And some people, that's enough. It's as long as they make enough that they have a roof over their head, then they aren't driven by the attraction in the private sector. So it's a mix. I came to the private, from the private sector after, I was in the Army in 57 and 58, but then I came back and after I turned 55. From the standpoint, I was lucky enough to be the, end up being a president of a company, and with that made some money. But I'll tell you, the last 5 years has been an eye-watering experience, seeing what young people are doing to keep this country safe. So it's not everybody's going out for that. There are some that are staying in. We're also trying to do a better job in the quality of life for the people that are in as well. But we'll have an ebb and tide and a flow. I'm going to talk tomorrow, so for those of you that will be there tomorrow, I'm on recruiting. Some of you folks are very talented. Instead of hacking in and attacking, why don't you come to the government and help us defend from attacks from nation states now, or transnational threats, not just from kids down the street. We can use some more talent, and if you're suitable and pass the entrance exam, so to speak, there's a career for you as system administrators, clearly on the defense side, and then after you're in, there's some offense stuff that we might be talking about. So some of that's good enough to keep some people in, others we'll see. Yes, this fellow here that, yeah. Did you hear the question? No. Let's see. Okay, he said something to the effect that I talked a lot about defense, but I alluded to that we also deny an adversary the ability to do the same. So what can we say about that? In this forum, not a whole hell of a lot. So if you're curious, tomorrow I'll have a Marine recruiter with me, but will the Army, Navy, Air Force will take suitable folks as well. Let's see. I'm being slightly humorous. It's known at the unclassified level that the United States clearly has a computer network defense capability that's growing. Call that information assurance by another name. Last October, by what we call a unified command plan, that was transferred from the Pentagon, from an organization that reports to me called DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, to a SINC, to a warfighter that has different authorities, and that went to SINC space. So we have a pyramid within the DOD. The Army comes up to a point, the Navy comes up to a point, the Marines, the Air Force, then it all comes to a focal point called the Joint Task Force for Computer Network Defense. That's housed in the Washington area. That reports now to SINC space. In a warfighting mode, he has responsibilities to protect the United States and or any of the computer network defense throughout the DOD, which is essentially worldwide. This October, so just in a couple months, another authority will happen. That's computer network attack. Yes, at the unclassified level, we admit we have a capability to attack others in a network attack, in an information attack. That is not done willy-nilly. That goes through as much control and rigor as nuclear release. And so I just want to admit, yes, we have that. Yes, we can use all the talent that we can find. And if that interests somebody out there, then we can talk later or sign up and go through a suitability and probably a clearance or two. Not probably, definitely a clearance or two, and we'll go from there. So let me say, if that downrange interests you, think about what you're doing today that might queer the deal. I just read in the Washington Post today, I just got back from Europe last night and then right flying out here today, the Washington Post, there's an article, and I'll bring it tomorrow, I didn't bring it tonight, of a person that's now a security consultant, used to be a hacker, now he's turned that talent around, We're looking for security consultants. We're looking for assistant administrators. We're looking for defensive specialists. And clearly then, after a while, there'll be some offensive opportunities there. But think about what you're doing today that might queer the deal later on. If you have a felony arrest, that's likely to exclude you from that club. Okay, yes. Yeah. That's a great question. I got it. The question was, the DoD has a lot of buying power, and what are we doing to affect the quality of software? I went on record a couple of years ago and was quoted in where's my buddy from Federal Computer Week over there, a couple of rags about part of the problem in the United States, in my view, is the software industry is delivering crap. And I fear, some of you aren't old enough, but go back to after about 1950, the General Motors or Ford or Chrysler or whatever were arrogant to saying, well, we build the best automobiles in the world and nobody's going to get to us. And within 10 years, they were in the sewer, and the Japanese products, which used to be crap, as right after the World War II, and as they got quality, and what did the American people go for was quality. I worry about the software industry doing the same thing. The software industry today is driven by first to market. First to market means you deliver crap. It was just the other day, Microsoft talked about delivering their last release, and it had 20,000 or 2 million or some huge number of defects known to be. Those defects, by and large, are the holes that then you all come into to raise hell in a system. The Solar Sunrise thing I mentioned before was a Solaris operating system, well-known operating system flaw. The discipline in the DoD, the system administrators, hadn't got around to fixing the patch. So part of this defense in depth is system administrators today are a hell of a lot better trained, and it's their first job, not their third job. I used to kiddingly say after you were the mess officer and the motor pull officer, then you might be a system administrator out in some base somewhere. No, it's no longer the case. Those system administrators are now, that's their first job, they're getting trained, and they're a hell of a lot more disciplined. So that's why it's getting harder for you all if you wanted to attack us. So the crusade is we need to get the paradigm shifted from first delivery, first to market, to first to market with quality. And that means we shouldn't buy this stuff until it passes a higher degree of quality check than we've had so far. But it's really going to take the companies, I think, a brutal lesson or two before they'll catch on to this. It's unfortunate, but I don't think we've learned from history in that regard. Yes. Right, yeah. Say the last part again. No. The trace back, track back. We've been talking about hack back, but if it's a legal, if it's a law enforcement issue, it's not a DoD issue. That's now we're talking about FBI or some law enforcement folks. And then the question was, what are you doing about hack back? And then does that mean you're going to attack a U.S. citizen? If it's a protected entity, hopefully no U.S. citizens will be attacking it, because if you do, you are in fact violating a law. Same thing. So let me amplify a little bit. Today, every case is first thought to be a law enforcement issue. There's a wholly different set of title, it's called Title III. that falls under, and then it goes to a law enforcement area. And frankly, at times there's a little bit of a tug. The law enforcement people wanted to investigate, to prosecute. DOD wants to cut off it so we don't lose any data or any service in a denial sense and so forth. So there's a little bit of push and tug, push and pull, tug there. But if we get this law passed about a protected entity, that immediately then swings to it's a national security thing, and then we have a different set of authorities to go back with. And it's not known usually at the beginning of attack where it originates anyway. If you look at if you look at Solar Sunrise, those attacks went in and out of the United States. Yes, they started in California. We didn't know that for a couple of weeks, but they went through the UAE, through Europe, back through the U.S., back out to some other sites, ISPs and so forth in Europe. I got a question here that says, in the information age, how does this affect our relations with allies? How do you trust their data? It's a great question. The NATO countries, tomorrow I'll introduce Dick Schaefer. He's standing over there if he raises his hand. He's been, he's my director of information assurance. He's been global, talking with all countries that will have anything to do in the context of receiving us. We're trying to spread the word. We started in NATO. It's truly the weakest link in a chain is as strong as the whole bloody thing is. And when we're operating in Kosovo with NATO nations, and for that matter with KFOR nations, the integrity of that data, the security or the integrity of the network and so forth is paramount. So how do you trust or what's your relation with allies? We're trying to educate each other on how to be more secure. And then the question was, how do you trust the data? That's a tougher issue, usually by multiple checks and so forth. But this is a very large issue. Just 2 weeks ago, I hosted, maybe it was three now, I hosted what we call a quad, where we had French, German, UK, and US, and it was a two-day tabletop exercise going through various scenarios, and then what do we need to do, essentially all in a protection standpoint. So we'll continue those efforts. Yes, way over there. I can't hear you. Say it louder.
If you have echelon, why do you need additional wiretap
privileges? Echelon is a system that that intercepts transmissions out of satellites. It has nothing to do with wiretapping. There's a national, international law. If something is in the RF, in the air, it is open to whoever wants to listen to it. Yes? The question was, I mentioned the number of defects in Windows 2000, and then why is there a shift to Windows from Unix and other systems? Roughly right? For interoperability reasons, and for we're not totally going to Microsoft, but for a lot of Office products and so forth, we are. Nothing against Unix or whatever, but for the ease of use and the popularity across the DoD, that's why we're doing that. Say again? How do we mitigate the risk with Windows 2000? I can say, how do you mitigate the risk with Unix or Linux? I'll assert no matter what you put in an operating system or once you hook up to the internet, you are vulnerable. It's just a risk management issue. So yes, we're risk managing by various layers of defense. Yes, way back there.
You got to go louder.
I'm sorry.
How can you be sure you're going back against the right person and you're not being spooked, that they're the real person?
That's a great question, and it's a difficult problem. You want me to tell you everything, huh? Okay, way back there. You. Okay, Ken, help me. Thank you. We've just started a R&D effort with Microsoft. We will do this with other companies as well, but the first one was Microsoft, to in fact do more research up front, to do more security on operating systems as they're being developed. I fully believe we need to do this during the development, not as patches after the fact. So we're doing this with Linux, Unix, Microsoft, whatever, and there's a few others I'm sure I've forgotten. So our mode now is to get involved with whatever that company's doing at the get-go to try and correct some of the gaps or holes, and we'll put some of our money into that as well. Yeah. Help me. I don't believe it's the only one. Say it again. I think the answer over here said they all do. Say it again. Say it. Joe will say something.
It's Jeff.
Jeff will say something.
I heard somebody in the audience here mention that the Morris worm proved that the Unix operators also can have homogeneous issues. So it's just not Windows. It might not be popular, but if you dig hard enough, I think you'll find the same problems across all platforms. Well, I'm not going to debate this with you here. We can do that later.
Yes. Oh, the lady here. Yeah, the question is, what are we doing with biometrics? Are we looking at that another layer? The answer is yes. We're waiting to, we've got several research efforts going on. Frankly, they're all over the place. The Army has an effort going on. The NSA has efforts going on and so forth. When the price is right, I'm sure we will add that. I'm totally convinced we'll add that as yet another layer. Frankly, one of the concerns I have, with thumbprints on a keyboard or on a device, I don't want soldiers losing their thumbs. So we can keep a bloody system going. So at the same time, we're serious about using biometrics, but we have to put it in a context for a soldier to use it. And if you're in an environment where you have a gas mask, a CW environment where you're in a suit and so forth, you get down to a few biometrics a few, damn few examples that might work, and then we're looking at the cost of implementing those. So the answer is in long-winded answer, yeah, we're looking at a lot of that, but how to implement it is, we haven't sorted that out yet. Yes. What? I'm told, let's make, Jeff, Joe. Jeff, I'm teasing you. Jeff says one last question, and you're lucky, Pierre. With every day. Tough. The question is, how do you, because of the budget cycles and so forth and configuration control, I'll paraphrase now, for interoperability and a few things like that, that slows down fixing problems because you're not refreshing fast enough, That's the current problem we have. What's the long-term solution? I don't know, but one example might be we don't buy anything. We don't lease anything, we just buy the service. And the service then continually upgrades. We're looking at that hard. There's a thing called the Navy Marine Corps Intranet, which is essentially a seat management for the whole bloody Navy and Marine Corps. That's what we're starting to look at. Then whoever wins that contract will then be refreshing in a technology sense, whatever it takes. Part of the problem in the DoD is exactly what you said. We're looking at what IT now is in a year, every 12 months, plus or minus a month or two, is in a refresh mode. We don't even plan to buy stuff unless it's 2 to 5 years out. And the way the rules with Congress are, that has to be have some specificity on what you're buying. You just can't say, I'm going to buy $70 billion worth of IT. It's got to get in with some specificity. That rolls over by the time that budget's being worked through. So that's part of the push and shoves. Part of the problem, I said, back to the laws of the country, which I support, but they need to change. Same way with the financial and the programming laws, the programming budgeting laws that the Congress owns. Some of that stuff started in the Civil War, and I'll assert what we're in today is a hell of a lot more dynamic than what was going on then. Thank you very much. See you tomorrow.